Welcome here to LREF. I'm Peter Murray, Chairman of New London Architecture, and New London Architecture is helping to curate this series of talks which accompany the exhibition. And before I start, I'd like to say that our thoughts are with people in Notting Hill after the dreadful events of last night, which I think is a stark reminder of the duty of care we have to those who occupy our buildings. But we live in interesting times, and I think LREF this year will be very instructive for everyone in the industry to learn a little bit more and try and find some clarity in the events of recent weeks and what the future holds for the development industry generally. And so we have a very good lineup of speakers today who perhaps can voice some of the concerns and look to some of the opportunities of the future and to give us a clear picture of where he thinks things are at the moment. We have Chris Giles, economics editor of the Financial Times, and Financial Times are supporters of LFA, so thank you for that. And I'd like to ask Chris to give his picture of where we are right now politically and economically. Chris.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's been quite a year, hasn't it? A referendum almost a year ago when I was here. It was just before the referendum. A new prime minister. A period of calm. Then triggering Article 50 to leave the EU, followed by an election, followed by a hung parliament, and very sad news this morning from the Grenfell Tower. So what I'm going to do is run through how the election, London's economy and the property market looks at the moment. Clearly, I've had to rewrite this speech over the weekend. And it's going to be, I'm going to title it, The Good, The Bad and The Ugly. The good news is that over the last year, the economy has performed about as well as we could have expected after the Brexit referendum and the Brexit vote. Things have gone a lot better than economists thought, and the economy has done pretty well. London in particular has done pretty well. The bad news is it's been for bad reasons. It's been for the wrong reasons. And most recently, a lot of the economic data is not very good, and it seems to be turning down quite rapidly right at the moment. And the ugly news is that we have a new bout of political instability. Nothing has changed, Theresa May likes to tell us, but I think it's one of the things that, one of the many things perhaps that she said that isn't quite true. Many things have changed over the past week. Perhaps everything has changed. So let's just have a look at what's happened over the past year, the good news. How has the economy performed? Well, here's some charts. They're quite small here, so I'm going to blow each one up so you can see them, dim them and blow up the first one. This is the growth of the UK economy. We've had three quarters since the referendum. Two from last year, the second half of last year, at the right-hand side of this chart, pretty good. In fact, much better than anyone thought. Everyone thought there'd be an economic shock from a vote to leave the EU, and in fact, pretty much nothing happened whatsoever. The first quarter of this year wasn't so good, wasn't unusually bad. 0.2% growth was okay-ish, but we wouldn't want it to continue. It's okay if it's one quarter like that. It's not okay if it continues at that sort of rate. And at first we thought that that 0.2 in the first quarter was, it had some sort of special factors to it, so maybe things would recover. I think at the moment we're less sure that things are going to pick up faster because some of the more recent data, both on industrial and construction, have been pretty weak. Some of the surveys are turning down. Inflation as yesterday went up to 2.9%. It's now rising significantly faster than people's earnings, and there's a real squeeze going on household incomes across the country, so we can't expect spending to rise very fast. Sterling, the other big thing that's happened, big decline in sterling. This is often quite seen to be good news. It makes our exports cheaper in the world, but also it makes our imports more expensive. We like to import quite a lot in this country, and with prices rising now at almost 3% and wages going up by a bit under two, it means that real earnings, so the real level of purchasing power people have, unfortunately, is declining again. We had a period when inflation was very low, where we were getting better off as a country after a very, very bad period after the financial crisis. And now we're back into a squeeze. And as we know from the period from 2010 to 2013, 2014, this sort of squeeze, not a disaster, we're not in a recession, but this squeeze is pretty painful and a pretty difficult time. What does it mean for London? This is just indicative, some London property prices. But you can see there, I don't take any of the individual boroughs very seriously because there's a lot of problems with the data, but you can see the blue being a bit cold, cold patches around the Thames, prime London, still things doing a bit better further out. But that was so that's the good news, and I'm sorry it's not brilliant news, but that's the best I can do, I think, today. The bad news is that the economy's done quite well for not brilliant reasons. This is the savings ratio. This is the proportion of people's incomes that households save every year. And as you see, you can draw it and you can draw it down. This is a very long series I've drawn. It goes back to 1963. So we're talking over 50 years. British households have not saved less ever. Not ever in 50 years. So the reason the economy did well in the second half of last year is because we spent money we didn't have. And we didn't save. We borrowed and didn't save. That cannot continue forever. So we can only have good growth in this country if incomes start to rise. We can't have that line continuing to fall, so spending goes up because people are saving less and less. That's the bad news. This is not sustainable. Everyone knows it's not sustainable, so something has to change. This is what I would have said anyway before the election. And also before the election, when we'd have thought, what are the big challenges for the UK economy? Well, we've got two big challenges. The normal economic issues, in which case it means, how do we get productivity to rise better so we can get sustainable growth, not growth predicated on people just borrowing more? And then there's some big Brexit issues. Right at the outset, there's the bill that the EU27 are going to present us with very soon. Roughly 50 billion quid is what they're going to say net we owe. There will be a big argument about that, but that's roughly what they'll present us with. Issues of EU citizen rights in the UK and UK citizens' rights in the EU. The issue of Ireland obviously got more important. Those were the three things in the first round of negotiations. And then for later on, and particularly for London, financial services is very important, as are whatever sort of free trade agreement we would like to sign with the EU27. Just to look at the bill in context, so £50 billion sounds like an enormous amount of money for any normal person. It's 50 with nine noughts on the end. It's not a huge amount of money in the context of the UK economy. That's £2,000 billion every year, not one-off £2,000 billion. The UK economy makes £2,000 billion every year, so it's about 2.5% of the economy. Even if we agreed that number, it wouldn't destroy us. So it's not something that really the UK government should get too fussed about. Obviously, we wouldn't want to overpay, but it's not the thing that should derail negotiations. And just look at what it means for London. This is what London pays to the rest of the UK. London there at the bottom. We pay £26 billion a year more in tax than we get in public services in this city. So that's half of that bill we'd pay every year to the rest of the country. London is the cash cow of the UK economy, and it needs to be. It is also the richest part of the UK economy. But that's just another way of putting that bill in context. Doesn't mean that everyone in London is having a great life at the moment because of house prices and particularly rent prices rising faster than incomes. The average, the middle income person in London has done worse since 2008 than any other region in the UK. And that's not because their incomes haven't risen, but they haven't risen as fast as housing costs. So London has a sort of an odd economy where things are going pretty well, but as I think everyone here will know, the housing is a major issue. And then the other thing I'd wanted to say about London was think about its industrial structure. How different are we from the rest of the country? There's London on the right, the UK on the left, the three bars I've shown of financial services. We're not totally dependent on financial services. So, you know, we are a diverse economy. Property's bigger in London, clearly. Professional services a lot bigger. Manufacturing a lot smaller. That's where we sort of differ. But I think you should also take this. It's a diverse economy. It's not just based on financial services whatsoever. So that's what I would have said. I would have gone into that in some more detail. But then this happened. We saw, even in London, we saw six seats go, ranging from Enfield Southgate in the north to Croydon Central, two to the Lib Dems in the southwest, and then Battersea and Kensington in the middle. And what does this mean for London and for the UK economy? Well, sometimes it's good to look at what other people from other countries think it means. And so here I'm going to show you the headline in the Süddeutsche Zeitung. It's not it's a very respected, quite a staid newspaper in Germany, and they were having a bit of fun. Oops, they did it again. I'll just loosely translate the words. The British Conservatives have a burlesque talent to unsettle their economy in votes or in elections. It says, London is strong and stable, but what about the Tories? If you think, what has it done to how they think they're going to negotiate us? That is the view from Brussels. So what does it actually mean for the Brexit negotiations? Well, this is really fluid at the moment. You can see from the headlines of the newspapers that it's not settled anymore. Unfortunately, the clock is ticking. We've already used up an eighth of the time with a two-year period. But now other versions of Brexit are back on, perhaps. So on the left there, we have the sort of the soft Brexit, which really means essentially trying to keep our economic relationship pretty close to the way it is today. If we join EFTA, and below that, that's the European Economic Area, that means we would have no tariffs, no customs procedures between us and the EU27. But obviously, there are big trade-offs with that. We would have to have European Court of Justice still having a big say in our economy, free movement of labour. And so there are big trade-offs if we want to go down that route. Then we have to think and tell the British public that there are things that they might have thought they were getting from Brexit which they are not going to get. Alternatively, I think the other thing, we can still go down the route the government was going down, which was to say we're going to get out of the single market, out of the customs union, and try and have a free trade agreement. That clearly is a lot worse. That damages our relationship with the EU, particularly in financial services and perhaps in customs procedures. Or we can try, which you sort of seem to be picking up from the newspapers and from the politicians, to sort of get a cake, have your cake and eat it, sort of Brexit. This is the one that everyone in Britain would like. We have to keep our relationship with the EU in the things we like, the bits of the club we like, pretty much unaltered, and not pay any money to the EU, not have to do what they say, and not have to and decide on immigration ourselves rather than having a common EU policy. Well, that last option, the have your cake and eat your Brexit, that won't happen. That's the one option that we know is not going to happen. It will not be agreeable to the EU27. And if we push that line, I think what we might end up is on the right, the sort of cliff edge. If we say, oh, come on, guys, you can do this, they'll just say no. And then we might have a cliff edge where we fall out altogether. So I think the government is still, at the moment, trying to go down the route it was going down before. But both a much softer version, which has big compromises on money, people, and jurisdiction of the European Court, or a crashing out are both much more likely than they seemed before the election. So what does this mean for the economy? Well, I'm not going to give you a forecast, but I'll give you the Bank of England's latest forecast. I think that's a very hard Brexit, sorry. This is the Bank of England's latest forecast, and as you can see, the black line, which is sort of goes through the middle of the dark green bar over to 2019, sort of says, oh, it's sort of about where we've been. So about 1% to 2% growth, not very good in historical terms, but not terrible either. But don't look at that middle of the thing, which is their central forecast. Look at the range they put on the side of that, which has going up from over 5% growth by 2019 a year to under minus 2% growth. That's not a great forecast, is it? The economy will do something between minus 2% and plus 5%. So what that just shows is, what that's really saying is, we don't know. The Bank of England doesn't know. No one else knows. If anyone tells you they do know, they're a charlatan. I think that's all you can say. It's highly, highly uncertain what's going to happen to the UK economy. It could be very terrible. It could be okay. So that is unfortunately the best news I can give. And we still have the big long-term problems of the UK economy, which is the hangover from the crisis. that our productivity performance is how much we get out for what we put in, how much output we get for the amount of work we do. That used to grow steadily at 2% a year, and that stopped growing in 2008 and hasn't grown since. And unless we get that growing again, we're not going to have a good performance, whatever happens in Brexit. What does it mean for the property market? Well, London and the property is probably at the sharp end of all of this, because often things get amplified through property prices, both because on supply side, people might not take decisions if there's a lot of uncertainty about both to build stuff or to give approval for stuff, and on the demand side to pay for things if you're not certain about where the future lies, or not reasonably certain, and that we certainly aren't. And the other thing the election has done is, I think, was one part of the Conservative manifesto that was very interesting, which was to think harder about compulsory purchase and whether you could use that as a way of getting land, particularly in areas such as London, at prices which were well below prices for residential property. That happens in public sector land, and the talk was to do this more on private sector land. It was obviously always going to be very controversial. I think with a hung parliament and a minority government, probably that won't happen anymore. So just to sum up, it looks like a very uncertain picture, pretty difficult out there. But do remember that London is a very big, strong economy, very diverse. And so if the UK doesn't do very well, we should be still doing better than most of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Now I'm going to ask our panel to give their views of how they see things and perhaps respond a bit to what we've heard. So our first speaker is Angus Knowles-Cutland, who's the Vice Chairman of Deloitte. Angus.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Chris. Peter, in your opening remarks, you said something interesting, which is we're living in interesting times, and as the audience will know, that's an old Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. And I was meeting with a Chinese delegation in town earlier in the week, and they came with some very sensible, detailed questions which would make sense in a planned economy and a planned political system, which were just unanswerable. And you know, where we got to was, this is the most uncertain, politically uncertain week and the most politically uncertain year for a generation. But then when we got onto the fundamentals of the London economy, it really took a turn for the better, because there are some very, very strong ongoing fundamentals to the London economy. A year's a long time, but a year ago, we published some work where we put London in the context of being a global city, looked at it against our rival cities around the world, and it was unalloyed good news a year ago. Looking at the high skills economy, looking at 22 high skills sectors, everything from architecture, media, creative, technology, professional, financial services, London is streets ahead of the competition. We've got 1.7 million high-skilled workers in London. New York, our nearest rival, is 1.1 million. You have to take the next four rival cities in Europe and add them up to get to London's position. Out of 22 sectors, London leads the world in 11, and we're number two in seven. So it's a fundamentally very, very strong position. And those fundamentals are still there. The Deloitte Crane survey, which covers commercial property and central office property in central London, tells a very strong story in the intervening year. So, you know, record levels new building, 13-year high. So we've had a good year subsequently. I think where we are in the London economy now, though, we have to take stock. And I think there are a number of drivers in the London economy that we have to think about. I'm just going to actually call out two of them in the little time I've got here, and as a reaction to what Chris says. And these are probably less understood than they should be. The first one is the impact of technology and automation on London, in particular employment in London. We've looked back over the last 15 years of the UK economy as a whole, and also London. And again, it's been very, very beneficial, the impact of technology, improving work, improving aspects of labour productivity. A lot more jobs have been created than have gone due to technology, although quietly in the background, half of secretarial jobs in London have gone, two-thirds of travel agents, two-thirds of counter clerks. So it's actually working its way, technology, through the economy, but a lot more high-skilled jobs have been created in London as a consequence of technology. Where we go from now, I think, is very interesting, because I think in the next 10 to 15 years, there's some factors at play. The cost of living in London, squeezing the ability to employ people in London, the national living wage, and potentially a shortage due to the impact of EU27 talent and other talent from outside the UK, could lead us to actually really accelerate in London the use of technology and automation. And that will change property demand, and it'll change the requirements of what actually commercial and office property actually looks like and does. And I think that's something to look at. And certainly our Deloitte stand outside, we actually really are focusing on what technology, digital technology, will do to the workplace in the next 10 years. The second trend, which again I think is really important to understand, because it will impact the London technology, is what happens to non-British workers in London. And I think too much of the narrative, the dialogue about Brexit and non-British people has been almost treating our friends from Europe and further afield as numbers, 100,000 here, 100,000 there. The reality is the attitudes of European workers really needs to be taken into account. And I think that all of us in business know that at a time of uncertainty in business, a big merger and acquisition, a corporate turnaround, new management, that's the time when your brightest and best and most talented colleagues are the ones who start thinking about moving the soonest. And I think that's something we've got to understand around Brexit and London, and the fact that a lot of our economy is powered by non-British workers. We've just conducted a survey which we're finalising, which we'll publish shortly, where we've surveyed over 2,000 non-British workers in the UK and in London. And I think looking at the first results, it actually says we're going to have to really take care of people who are here. Otherwise, we're going to have some major skill shortages emerging. And in fact, the natural answer is to say, well, we should have the British workers to replace those leaving. In reality, when you look at the sectors that are most exposed, today we don't.
Thank you very much. And Fiona Fletcher-Smith, you're Executive Director, Development, Enterprise and Environment at GLA. So tell us the view from City Hall.
Well, it was very interesting this morning. I remarked to a couple of people that I sat here on this platform this time last year talking about the extreme uncertainty around Brexit. I find myself sitting here this year where we've got uncertainty piled upon uncertainty. We are taking some glimmers of hope, although we completely recognise Chris's analysis of where we are. One glimmer of hope for us is, surprisingly, the influence of the DUP on our government. Whatever else has been said about the DUP in the last few days, one thing, and I can say this as the daughter of an Irish Customs and Excise officer, they are desperately interested in cross-border trade. So the influence that they will have and other elements within the Conservative Party on a soft or hard Brexit, we're seeing that as very hopeful. In the run-up to the election, we were being told by government ministers and officials that we were exaggerating the problem of Brexit for London, particularly in relation to skills. We were using a very conservative figure of about 25% of the workforce on our building sites being from Europe. That is a very conservative figure, and many in the room will argue it's closer to 70%. We were told we were exaggerating. And this issue for London is massive, and we need to do something about it. The other thing that we took from the election that we see as really quite positive, and we're yet to crunch the numbers fully, but it's looking at the turnout and the segments within the turnout. The number of young people who came out to vote, we're really, really impressed with that, and that's going to have an impact on policy development generally. If we look at a survey that was carried out for Shelter by YouGov, they did a survey of people generally in London looking at their attitudes to growth. And they found that in the over 55 population, only 15% of people were prepared to take more housing growth in their local area. That's 1.5%. But if you look at the 23 to 30 population, it's about 51% are prepared to take extra growth in their local area. Now, one of the issues you'll all be aware that we're exploring within the London plan is how we look at density around our transport nodes and well-connected town centres. And that sort of split in the population is going to be very, very interesting. And the third slightly positive thing to say is I'm still meeting as many investors as I was a year, 2 years ago. I'm actually seeing people now who feel to me to be more serious investors. I'm seeing fewer time wasters. I'm a public servant, so I see everybody. But they feel serious to me. The difference we're noticing, though, is when we're talking about residential development, we are talking about build-to-rent. We aren't seeing as many pure private sales developments coming forward. We're also seeing an interesting development in outer London, which is also quite helpful to me in planning terms, where we would often expect pressure on our strategic industrial land, our logistics sites to flip to resi. We're not seeing that pressure, and actually industrial and logistics in some of the outer areas that are well connected in the road networks, we're seeing them competing on a fairly even keel in land price terms, which is very interesting. Doesn't help me with my housing numbers, but it certainly helps me with the needs we have in London in terms of workspace. So yes, London fundamentals remain the same. City Hall's incredibly positive about what we can do. You will have heard the message, London is open. We still remain here to help make investment in London as easy as possible. But in common with Angus, there are some questions investors are asking me that I can't answer and I won't be able to answer for some time.
Thank you very much. Joe Negrini, CEO of Croydon. Tell us the view from South London.
Well, I guess the key thing for us and the way that I'm looking at it is not only as a local authority, but also in terms of being a big business in outer London. Local authorities have a lot of different roles, and the election results, particularly for us, you know, what we're looking at is what's going to happen with government policy and the future of local government finance. And if that doesn't seem relevant to these types of audiences, local authorities have a huge role to play on a number of counts. One where, you know, we have a turnover. I'm just talking about, I'll be parochial about Croydon, what I know. You know, we have a turnover of £1 billion. We have a large investment portfolio. We're probably the largest landowner. We are the largest landowner in Croydon. And, you know, the way that developers use us is very much to de-risk development. But it all depends on us having a very clear medium-term financial plan. And at the moment, we don't have that. And there were plans in terms of, obviously, 2019 rolling out the new local government finance arrangements, which would mean relying purely on business rates. So when you're looking at the kind of economic climate at the moment and thinking what's actually happening to our business base, because the housing needs that we've had in London and the impact that's had on flipping from, if you like, commercial to residential, and that was happening before the election, the issue for us now is what's going to happen with local government finance and what does that mean when developers are coming to Croydon or any other local authority asking us to help them get their schemes going. I think in terms of, from our point of view, we've been very fortunate. We've had an Article 4 within the centre of Croydon, and we've also got a growth zone with the help of Fiona and colleagues at the GLA. So we have our investment kind of sorted. However, the other point for us is investment also relies on a very clear medium-term financial strategy, and we don't know what that is, as Chris said. We don't know what that future looks like for us to take informed decisions about how we're going to invest and what we're going to do with our infrastructure needs within the borough. What's happening in terms of what we've noticed over the last 12 months, to agree with Fiona, we're getting a lot more serious investors. We're getting a lot of American investors coming to talk to us about PRS. We're also noticing that construction starts are slowing down slightly, but I think the upside, and there is always an upside, is that what we're noticing is that people are talking to us about proper mixed use again, which is a really, really good thing, because I think what we were concerned about even a couple of years ago was that we were getting so much residential, and before we put our Article 4 direction in, so much poor quality permitted development coming through in Croydon that we were extremely concerned about what was going to happen to our business base. I mean, on the back of that change of, I guess, over the last 12 months, you know, obviously huge role for outer London, particularly places like Croydon in terms of government relocation, and the more difficult it gets in central London, we love it because it means it benefits us in terms of being able to create businesses and homes in areas with their own integrity in outer London, which is the way we need to start thinking about London in this kind of polycentricity. But in terms of, you know, from our side, what we're most concerned, what I'm most concerned as a CEO of a large company in outer London, what I'm most concerned is what is actually going to happen to government policy in terms of Greg Hand's approach in terms of housing, what's going to happen now with business rate retention, what's going to happen from 2019 onwards. So from our side, the uncertainty is not just about what's going to happen with the property market, but what's going to happen to our base to be able to assist you, to help you de-risk your schemes so that you can actually, we can have see a range of construction starts happening across the capital.
Thank you very much. And our final speaker is John Mulryan, MD of Ballymore Group in the UK. So John, house builder's point of view.
Yeah, from our perspective, I mean, clearly for the London economy, creating more housing that is affordable, so not just affordable housing, but private housing that is affordable for people is really important to businesses in this city. And I think that's something that's a real challenge at the moment. What we're seeing, just in terms of the market itself, we had a look back 12 months ago, roughly, when Brexit happened, and the 12 months prior to that. So in terms of our sales rates during that period, I think we're probably down about 40% in terms of our sales rate year on year. I think that's... not sure if that's consistent across the market, because that will depend on whether you're launching particular projects or not, but I think there is certainly sales rates across the board on new build properties and private sale will have dropped significantly, and that's probably part of the reason why we're seeing less construction starts in the private sale market. That has been compensated for to a degree with the PRS market, so I think private rented sector and build to rent has certainly taken up some of that slack. So although we're seeing overall housing construction starts fall, I think they're falling more gently than maybe they would have otherwise if the build-to-rent market hadn't picked up that slack. From a private developer's perspective, I think there's some other challenges that we're dealing with at the moment as well. We've seen a huge amount of inflation over the last 5 years in terms of our construction costs, and that has had a significant impact on a number of developments. And I think as long as over the last 5 years what we've seen is private sale prices increasing, has kind of compensated for that. So, you know, ultimately projects still continue to be built out based on higher sales prices than were originally forecast. But I think that's a major concern. And I think in addition to construction costs, what we're seeing is throughout our planning applications that I think it's, you know, we're seeing increased affordable housing levels are being required, and additional 106 contributions that we're needing to make are significantly above where they were 3 or 4 years ago. So I think that the impact that's having is that I think there's just less land in the city that is viable for residential development. So, I mean, Fiona mentioned about industrial or parts of outer London where industrial and logistics are now competing with residential as a land use. And I think that's going to become more and more of a problem in terms of trying to increase our supply of housing in the city. So I think outside of the build-to-rent market, I think within private sale, I think it is a challenging market for developers at the moment. And I think, you know, margins are decreasing, and inevitably that's going to mean that certainly from the private sales side, you're going to see, unless something changes, you're going to see less development, which is going to put increased pressure on housing pricing and ultimately increased pressure on businesses to attract talent into this city, which we badly need.
Thank you very much. Now, we were going to have a bit of a discussion between us before going to the floor, but I think since we've got about 10 minutes and with a number of people here, I think we'll go straight to questions from the floor if somebody would like to ask one. And we've got a question in the middle there. If we can get a microphone, we'll come to you so that everyone can hear the question. Thank you.
Yes, good morning. Adrian Griffiths from Chapman Taylor. We're architects. A question for Chris, actually, and you said in one of your slides about the fact that people aren't saving anymore or not saving enough anymore, and that had to change. But the reality is when you look at the millennials, who are an important part of our future, they are not in a position where they can save. They're maxed out on, well, they can't afford a house. They're maxed out on their rent. They've accepted they can't save. They've accepted they can't buy a house. And actually, they'd rather spend their money on having an experience So moving forward, as that quarter of the that sector of the society grows, less people will be saving. So how do we feel that might feed back into the economy?
The short answer is we don't know. I don't disagree with your analysis, by the way. I think that's essentially right. One of the big thing in the economy, you know, I showed big aggregate pictures of the economy as a whole, but we know the economy is made up of millions of people and different groups are acting in different ways. And age is now one of the biggest drivers of the way people behave, not only in elections, but in the way they behave day to day in their spending. There's no sign that millennials want to have a different life to their parents. They actually have the same ambitions, but they don't think they can realise them, particularly in a city like London. On one level, it might mean that we can run a lower savings rate for longer. For the country as a whole, that is problematic because ultimately, if you don't save domestically, the country doesn't save domestically, then either it doesn't have funds for investment or it has to rely on foreigners. And if we're not seen as a stable place for foreigners, I thought it was very good news to hear that people are thinking of that you've got serious investors, but we do need serious foreign investment if we are not domestically going to save. And of course, if we have lots of foreign investment, that means we owe foreigners money. And so more in the future, more of our money flows out in the returns to those investments, flows out of the country. So it's not the most sustainable long-term platform for the UK.
Just pick up on your point about millennials wanting the same lifestyle as their parents. And Fiona, did I understand that now the voting patterns that you saw will be reflected in thinking about the London plan so that higher density outer London development side might be given greater priority because millennials are looking for, more urban rather than suburban experience in...
It's not just the millennials looking for it. We're also seeing that older people are sort of migrating back from outer London and the suburbs because they want to be closer to services, hospitals, theatres. People are living longer and they want to have fun. We were thinking about this long before looking at the voting records, and we have been doing some polling and some analysis around people's views of growth. I think what will make it easier for us is this. If people have been bitten by the bug now of the election and they realise that voting makes a difference, they might be more participative in local decisions on planning. So instead of traditionally at a planning committee, you will see the over 55s being the objectors to growth, we might see the 23 to 30-year-olds being the people speaking in favour of some growth. It's early days. We have yet to look in detail at the turnout figures and who these people were who turned out. But this is just our early assumption that this could be a good thing for us in London.
Very interesting. We have a question there.
Going. Yeah. Hello, yes, it's Peter Bill from EG. Chris mentioned that the one decent idea in the Tory manifesto about CPOing land at current use value might go because it's contentious. And I wondered, and it seems like a good idea to some of us, but I wonder whether perhaps, I don't know, Fiona might answer, would it have been a good idea? Should they try and retain it? Should they just let it go? Perhaps at Croydon, you own lots of land. Would it make any difference to you? Worse or better? But Fiona, really, yeah.
Joe, you wanted to ask Joe?
Well, no, Fiona, really.
Shall I start? We are up for exploring any ideas that will make growth easier. So we are in conversation with Treasury continually about these ideas. However, we did see problems with how contentious the CPO proposals were. But that said, we will continue to work with government officials on lots of ideas. And some of them will be less palatable than others, I'm afraid, for both the public and private landowner.
2 points from me on that. One is that in terms of what's been happening, I know not just in Croydon but other parts of outer London, the reason why it's been so difficult over the last 12 months is people, developers and investors have paid stupid money for sites, absolutely stupid money. So things that maybe 2 years ago were worth 20 million or so, they were paying 40, 50, 60 million, which is bonkers. So I think so that's the first point. So in terms of, you know, the impact of CPO, I mean, a lot of the local authorities, we've done it ourselves. are getting much more proactive in terms of trying to assemble things ourselves, notwithstanding what I said earlier about the risks involved with that at the moment. But in terms of our own kind of approach, it may not be about government policy bringing in about CPO, but I know that individual local authorities are already doing that now, being much more aggressive in actually pulling together planning applications and actually CPOing sites where they feel that things aren't happening.
Angus, you were on the London LEP, I think, aren't you? What role does that have, do you think, in ensuring?
Well, so under the new mayoralty, there's a new LEP formula. It's actually, we call it the LEAP in London. It's got a number of relevant roles, but obviously it's to work with the mayoralty to actually ensure business and GLA public sector policy is actually joined up. So one of the roles at the moment is to work with the mayor and Rajesh Agrawal, the deputy mayor for business, to make sure that the new economic development strategy it makes sense for London, for all Londoners, but also makes sense from a business and investment point of view. So it's a new LEP, but it's got some teeth. I'd say the profile of the LEP this time around. One other thing I would add. Actually really reflects London quite well. So the business membership is probably more reflective of tech businesses, startups, and larger established businesses like mine. So it's really quite a good cross section looking at working with the mayor on his plan.
Thank you very much. Yeah, Fiona.
Just add something on CPO to follow on from what Joe said. The public sector has an immense number of powers already. It's an issue of whether they're going to use them or how they're going to use them. We in City Hall have CPO powers now that we haven't had before. It's about being proactive. I'm always sort of nervous about another new set of laws or regulations, because what it does is sort of makes the landscape uncertain again. It's really about using the existing powers more effectively and having the skills and the, you know, frankly, the balls within local authorities to do that.
Thank you very much. And John, we heard in the first question, people maxed out cost of housing. What can the industry do to bring costs down, or what changes might there be to do that?
I think that it was specifically relating to millennials and that, and I think there's some interesting new projects coming forward. We haven't done one, but shared living and those kind of ideas I think are really interesting. And you know, the truth of it is, if you're a graduate at a university and you're in the early parts of your career, I think probably in a relatively small apartment with some great facilities on the ground floor is a great way to live, and in a more community where you might meet people of your own age and your own thinking. So I think working with planning authorities to try and make sure that those types of smaller dwellings actually are seen as a positive thing, as opposed to necessarily seeing as something that is kind of old shoebox apartments or something like that. So I think that kind of that kind of thinking for millennials particularly, I think, is interesting. I think the reality is, once you get to a certain age, people will want more traditional housing. But certainly that is one interesting development, and we're looking at that. And I think the PRS market, built to rent, is obviously playing a much bigger role now, which is going to help the city as well in terms of providing more affordable rental accommodation.
Thank you very much. Well, we are up to time. We have a busy programme today, so I'm afraid we need to stop, although lots more to talk about. But we do have a couple of days of networking, sharing information, lots of seminars about some of these key issues which are of such concern to the industry at the moment. So we hope you find Elbreth very useful. I'd like to thank our panel today for introducing the debate about what is going to happen to the development industry in the future.